Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have.
That's the sound of the elite men's race start of the American Birkie Beiner last year. It'll sound much different this year due to the pandemic. Plus, if you're out on the Lake Superior ice and you hear something that sounds like a Star Wars lightsaber or a humpback whale, get off!
It really does change hour by hour out there.
We'll hear a scientific explanation of just how unpredictable the ice can be with very little warning. Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
Simply Superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have.
That's the sound of the elite men's race start of the American Birkie Beiner last year. It'll sound much different this year due to the pandemic. Plus, if you're out on the Lake Superior ice and you hear something that sounds like a Star Wars lightsaber or a humpback whale, get off!
It really does change hour by hour out there.
We'll hear a scientific explanation of just how unpredictable the ice can be with very little warning. And before we get to those stories, it's member drive time at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we only have a few seconds to ask for your support of the station you love. You count on WPR to make a difference in your day, to inform and entertain you. Now, support the radio that you rely on. Make your difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you. And welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Burke Washington, and I'm using my full name and giving a full disclosure to dispel any similarity between my middle name and the major event that happens in these parts this time of year, the American Birkie Beiner. It's North America's largest and longest cross-country ski race, and typically it brings in 11,000 participants from around the world. It's also an economic engine with a budget of $1.5 million and pumping many more times that into the local economies. But this year, as you very well know, there's a pandemic going on, and large events are discouraged, if not canceled altogether. The John Bear Grease Sled Dog Race was held 2 weeks ago, but no spectators were allowed, and suffice it to say, a few dozen mushers and even their dog teams don't quite match the thousands of skiers. Spectators to the Birkie can number as many as 30,000, and they too will be prohibited from lining the route this year. That route is also being changed to begin and end in Cable so that skiers won't have to be bused to the starting line. And most significantly, the race will be held over 5 days instead of one, starting next Wednesday, to spread out the racers and minimize contact. With us to tell us about those changes and others to make the event as COVID-safe as possible is the race's executive director, Ben Popp. Welcome to Simply Superior.
Thanks for having me.
And you probably didn't know my middle name was Burke, so again, full disclosure.
I like it. That's a good omen.
It's actually short for Birkenstein, and if you meet a Birkenstein, it's a relative of mine. There are very few of them. And I don't know how many are cross-country skiers. We'll have to look into that. So can you make the race truly COVID-safe?
Yeah, you know, I think we really believe we can. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. You know, we have the fortune of an amazing staff. We've had a lot of time to prepare. You know, COVID really sank in just shortly after last year's Birkie, and we've been lucky enough to not only learn from a lot of other events that have been planning and trying and that are now slowly coming back online, but we really have the luxury of having time and space. You know, a lot of major events are unable, you know, the Chicago Marathon, for instance, can't close down roads in downtown Chicago for a whole week, as an example. And so for us to be able to spread out the events over a long period of time, as well as then spread out the folks that are actually coming to the event at any given time, really allows us to create a medium that you know, even though it sounds like thousands and thousands of people are coming, when you actually look at it on the ground, they're going to be spread out. And, you know, gosh, some of the biggest waves where normally they're crowded with 500-600 people and 7,000-9,000 people going all within an hour or two. This year, when you look at them spread out over 5 days, the average wave size around 60 or 70 people spread out over 15 minutes is really going to ensure that they have plenty of ability to distance. And, you know, while not being able to come down Main Street and the thousands of screaming fans, this year's experience is going to be all about being on the trail. And even out on the trail, the modifications, like, for instance, at the aid stations, usually they're there waiting with nearly 100 volunteers to hand them water and food. This year they have to be self-reliant and carrying much of their own nutrition and water. So while the experience will be very different, certainly that Berkey fever excitement will live within and hopefully get them over the athletic accomplishment of having to go nearly 45 kilometers this year.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the alternatives, and other races have done this and other types of races, is to have it virtually. How would that work and why not do that?
Yeah, so we actually have a hybrid model this year for the Berkey. In fact, we have over 40 virtual partner sites. And, you know, I think I like to tell people that this really isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all Berkey. You know, if you live in Duluth and have a cabin in the area or can make a day trip, it's very different than a participant that might have to try and come from California or Florida or internationally. So this year, first and foremost, we don't have any international participants, unfortunately. And secondly, we have these virtual partners and said, hey, if it's really difficult for you or you don't feel safe traveling to our area, you can ski your Berkey virtually. So in other words, there's sites everywhere from California to out east and all around the Midwest where people can go ski their Berkey or even actually at their own home trail. We developed an app that they can record their virtual Berkey, if you will, somewhere else. And it allows them to participate as a part of the event, even if they're not able to actually travel. And to this point, we've had over a third of the participants choosing virtual. So, you know, it's not only gives them that experience that they feel safe about not having to travel here, it allows them to still feel a part of the community and then certainly reduces the, when we back to the creating a safe environment, we obviously have less people, which makes it even more COVID friendly in that regard. So it is definitely an interesting model. The one time I tell people that you might be able to ski the Berkey by not being in Cable or Hayward, and so we'll have to see if it ever carries into the future or not.
And we have a clip from your website of one of those virtual race participants, Olympic gold medalist Keegan Randall. Here she is.
Hey, fellow Berkey skiers, this is Keegan Randall. I am here out on the trails in British Columbia where I live, and well, I wish I could be heading to Hayward in 2 weeks. I'm going to play my part, stay home, but I'm going to do my virtual 50K from here.
And as you mentioned, other organizations, races, contests have done virtual. Is it completely honor system? How does it actually work?
Yeah, you know, so we have a variety of ways that you can actually record your virtual Berkey. We have some partners, you know, parks and other ski trail systems that are actually going to put out timing devices. So over that 9-day period that you can ski your virtual Berkey from the 20th through the 28th, that if you are at one of these sites, you can actually have them time you as part of your virtual Berkey. Others, you can actually just record it on a watch, a GPS watch, a Garmin or Suunto or those sorts of things and upload it to us. And then we also have a Berkey app that's downloadable that you can record your event right in the app, and it records you out skiing. And last but not least, we are definitely a trusting bunch, and that if you aren't able to secure any of those options, you can actually have somebody verify that you did the distance and time you did and email it to us, and we will upload those results in. And so, you know, again, it's going to be a one-of-a-kind Berkey this year, but, you know, all in all, at the end of the day, it's just about participating within a bigger community to feel good about being active outside.
Mm-hmm. One of your, I guess it's a safety provider would be a way of putting it, notes that you have indeed gone extra lengths to ensure a safe event, but that you're still bucking both national and state pandemic recommendations for large public gatherings. So what do you say to people who say that you know, you're going against recommendations. We all need to bite the bullet and, you know, just take it in this year.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's, we certainly recognize those concerns. And, you know, I think, again, we've had the fortune of having a variety of races already, and been able to show that the events that we're putting on are safe. We have no known cases traced back to any events that have been going back to all the way last September, from trail runs and mountain bike races and ski events now this winter. And, you know, I think the other thing that is really important to recognize about the Cable Hayward area is we're an absolute tourist destination. And I think it would be one thing if we were going to try and put on an event and nobody ever visited here, and the community wasn't used to seeing a lot of visitors. But, you know, we can even look at our trail pass numbers of just general recreational skiers, record numbers this year. And, you know, talking to other businesses, grocery stores and gas stations, the amount of visitors that we've had since the pandemic has started has been astronomical, because everybody wants to, quote unquote, escape to the North Woods. And so because of that, the local community partners, again, the gas stations, grocery stores, hotels, bars, restaurants, have been really good at being able to put in safety COVID precautions that will allow visitors to be safe within our community. So I think when you couple the fact that we have really, really good safety protocols during the event that I think public safety has recognized, coupled with the fact that we are an absolute tourist destination that have had huge amount of visitors coming to it, that helps the community be prepared for those folks that are going to come and ski. And then couple that yet again with the fact that we have really reduced numbers due to the virtual options, that I think at the end of the day, it's an important part of our community, not only certainly from the tourist dollars that it brings in for our small businesses, many of which that are struggling during the pandemic, to being an outdoor sport that we can create a safe medium. I think at the end of the day, we're confident about holding the event moving forward in a safe way.
That tourism is, again, a double-edged sword, though, because, well, earlier in the summer or last summer, we had various tourist places saying don't go up there. Most memorable in the region is outside of Grand Marais, right? Somebody knocked down some trees across Highway 61, which I think one way to stop it. But and then others have gone the opposite, saying, you know, we'll come up to our lodge. But the bottom line is, again, it's increasing visiting and touring, you know, in a time when. And we know Wisconsin, my head hurts over figuring out what is allowed and what isn't allowed, because it's gone back and forth. The governor has issued orders. The legislature has done otherwise. I can't tell anymore. I know I'm supposed to be a news person, but I'll check it up the day of broadcast here and figure it out. But seriously, bringing a large number of people, is that, in a word, responsible?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I look at it in a broader context. I think if you look and say bringing people to the area is a bad thing, then I think you're right. We should just shut down all of tourism and shut down all of northern Wisconsin. But I just don't think that's realistic. I think we have to look at it in the broader picture and say, can we do it responsibly? Can we bring people here in a safe manner? And if that's the case, I think it is something that we can and should continue to do, because it is the essence of what drives our economies forward here. And I go back to, each of us has our own responsibility. When we do have visitors here, we take responsibility for that environment when they're out on the ski trail or picking up a bib or those things. And then we know we have community partners that have similarly played their role and played their part in if they visit a grocery store, they get picked up or take out food, or they have to stop and get gas. They have also taken those precautions. And I think that as we put those together, that at the end of the day, that is the scenario that we're in now and as part of this pandemic. And I think the other part that's evolved a lot is we've learned a lot. When the pandemic first hit, in early in the spring and then into the summer, we didn't know a lot of things about transmission. We didn't know a lot of things about how the virus was going to spread. And so we were certainly had a variety of concerns. And not that it's any less virulent now, but we've learned a lot about how the virus does spread. And we've talked about double masking and the importance of washing hands. And is it transmitted through touch as opposed to aerosol, inside versus outside? And again, as we learn all those things, it's allowing us to adapt, again, be it a gas station or an event, And as we see more of them coming online, and, you know, there are now more events, larger scale events that are coming back online, triathlons. There was just another, you were part of the World Lopit series of races around the world. There just was a World Lopit race the last two weekends, one in Italy, one in Czechoslovakia. And so, again, I think as we're learning about the precautions necessary for, be it an event or a community to function during the pandemic. And we're also really fortunate, of course, now as more and more of the vaccine becomes available to our 65, you know, our most vulnerable age groups in the 65 plus, that too is going to continue to help reduce the risk within those populations.
All right. We are speaking with Ben Popp, the executive director of the American Berkey Binder. So what will it look like? We actually are speaking with at least a couple of participants who aren't sure if they'll be participants. They're still hedging right now. What do they need to do? You know, what do the participants need to do? And what's it going to look like for spectators? And where can they see it?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately this year for spectators, there's really not much to see. You know, that is one of the modifications that we do have. We've asked that there be no spectators. There's no areas for them to spectate at, if you will. But there will be, we do have a live stream and live cameras that people can tune into, as well as they can sign up to get text alerts of where their favorite skier is as they pass through different checkpoints out on the course, kind of being able to keep tabs of them. But what we've really tried to do from an event standpoint is reduce those interface points between skiers and other skiers, or skiers and volunteers, or skiers and staff. So first and foremost, absolutely, we've asked all participants to take a COVID test within 5 days of travel. You know, now there's a lot of, in Wisconsin, Vault is a very common one. You can go on the DHS and you can get a test overnighted right to you, and you overnight it back in, and all free of charge. So that's, you know, the first step. And then once they actually get to the course and pick up their bib, it's a drive-in bib pickup. They don't get out of their car. And then they get to the start line. And as you mentioned earlier, it's actually a loop course. Rather than having to bus them from one end to the other, they'll park at the traditional Berkey start line and actually ski in a loop that'll take them from headed south towards Sealy and then headed back up to right where they started. That way they're insured to have a warm space when they get back. That's private. It's their car. So they provide transportation and a warm space with their car. And, you know, out on course is too going to be very different. As I mentioned, you know, normally they're used to having all sorts of support. And this year it's all about the athletic endeavor of getting out there, testing yourself. But you're going to have to be quite a bit more self-reliant. You're going to have to be bringing your water and your nutrition, such that it really reduces the interface with volunteers or other staff when you're out on course and making the Berkey again. So I think it's really going to look very different from the pomp and circumstance, but yet when you're out on the ski course, it's just going to be about testing yourself and seeing if you can are up for the challenge.
And wearing a double mask may not be a bad thing in 20 below, right?
No, you know, it's funny you say that, obviously. You know, sometimes masking is very difficult for people that are uncomfortable, but actually, skiers are very used to wearing it. You know, oftentimes in the winter, it's cold and you are wearing face masks. And so all of our events, we do require people that as soon as they leave their car, they have masks on, and then they have to carry them with them so that if they do need to stop at an aid station for any reason, they have to put their masks back on. And then as soon as they finish, they have to put their masks back on before they, as they walk to their cars. And now with double masking, I tell you what, these last few days where the average temperature has been about -3, lows in the -30s up at the start line, it's really, it's perhaps an advantage to have a double mask on. Your glasses don't fog, and you can certainly ensure that you're safe when you're around other people.
Right. And you mentioned there will be a live stream. So is there a URL where one can watch this?
Yeah, if you go to berkey.com, just the website, we have a bunch of cameras placed around the course. And then we also have a snowmobile crew that goes out and snowmobiles along the skiers and takes video footage and then comes back. And there's a delay of, about an hour, hour and a half, that you can actually then go back and sort of watch a replay of the race itself and how it evolves. And that'll be taking place on Saturday and Sunday, the last 2 days of the event. But the other cameras will be up all week long. In fact, if you go there now, you'll start to see some of them starting to populate under, I believe they're just called trail cams or live cams from the Berkey, and you can get a sense of what it might look like and what the venue will start to evolve into.
Once again, the website is Berkey.com. That's BIRK.com. And full disclosure, my middle name is Burke, spelled BIRK. No relation or endorsement one way or the other. We have been speaking with Ben Popp, the executive director of the American Berkey Biner. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, and enjoy being active outside.
Coming up, last week, the city of Duluth rescued 26 anglers off the ice on Lake Superior. Is it safe to head back out? We'll hear from the experts.
The ice is thin, come on, dive in. Underneath my lucid skin, the cold is lost, forgotten. Hours pass, days pass, time stood still. Light gets dark and darkness fills my secret.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So last week, the region made national news when 26 ice anglers on Lake Superior had to be rescued when they found themselves on an ice floe headed toward Brighton Beach, or maybe two harbors if they had stayed on long enough. Like anyone who learns from experience, they realize the big lake can change in an instant and vowed to stay off the ice for the rest of the winter, right? Not quite. Just hours later, anglers were back out there, according to a spokeswoman for the city of Duluth, which had dispatched rescue crews and stands by to do so again if needed. Here to tell us just how the lake does behave, as much as can be predicted, are University of Minnesota Duluth Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences, John Swenson. Welcome to Simply Superior, John.
Thank you, Robin. Nice to be with you.
And also Joe Moore, Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Duluth. Welcome to Simply Superior, Joe.
Nice to be here. Happy to talk.
So let's just go right to the science. How does the big lake work when it comes to ice on top of the lake? Who wants to tackle that one first?
This is John. I'm happy to take a crack at that. Basically, Lake Superior is an immense volume of water. It spends most of the summer trying to warm up a little bit, and then it spends most of the winter trying to cool off. The lake cools off by losing heat to the atmosphere, and then at some point we get the lake cooled off enough, generally late January, where we start to actually form rather extensive ice cover, and that brings us to where we are in mid-February this year. Obviously, we've had some really good conditions of late for ice to form, and I think I'll leave that for Joe to touch on it. That seems like more in his wheelhouse.
Right. But before we get to that, John, the lake doesn't freeze all the way to the bottom. The lake is very, very deep, but even close to the shore, how much does it freeze? And I know that in recent years it hasn't frozen over, too. So, you know, how thick is that ice close to shore and how far out?
Well, that's a great question, Rob. And then just a reminder that water has a very unique property, and that is that it reaches its maximum density, so when it's heaviest, so to speak, at about 4 degrees Celsius, 40-ish degrees Fahrenheit. If you continue to cool water below that temperature, its density actually decreases, so it becomes lighter. So because of that, when water freezes, it floats. So the ice floats on top of the lake, and that's a good thing. Otherwise, the world would be very different. To get to your question specifically, generally in the near shore area, based on my experience, the ice depths right now, yesterday it was 4 to 6 inches in front of my house here on the north shore. The longer it stays cold, the deeper the ice forms, the thicker it gets. It doesn't usually, in my experience, get thicker than a foot or two. And that really hasn't happened much in recent memory.
Hmm. All right. So, Joe, you are the warning coordination meteorologist. What sort of warnings do we have for how thick the ice is or isn't for whatever it is you want to do out there? And by the way, I mean, people are doing things from just walking and driving vehicles. And we do have the ice road, when we have the ice road, going out to Madeline Island. So it's got to be strong enough to hold that. How do we know when it is safe to go out?
You know, that's a great question. And that's actually something that the National Weather Service does not really warn for is what conditions are like out on the lake. We don't put out a warning to say that or any kind of a statement to really say if ice is safe to walk on or not. And part of the challenge with that is just it varies so much, even within a single day. When we look at, you know, satellite imagery of the lake forming and breaking up and the wind pushing it around, it really does change hour by hour out there in terms of how thick the ice is, whether it's connected to the shoreline or not, whether it's starting to stack on top of each other and becoming less stable. It's just such a unique and continually changing phenomena that it's really just it's nearly impossible for us to predict at any one point in time whether conditions will be safe or not. Now, we do issue marine weather information, and outside of when the shipping season is closed in the deep of winter, we do issue nearshore warnings. We'll put out a small craft advisory if conditions are getting windy up to 33 knots, about 22 to 33 knots. When they start to get above 34-knot winds, that's when we issue a gale warning. And typically, you know, in the fall when we get a little bit of that ice, if we have a gale warning, that means that ice is probably going to be moving around, even if it's in the harbor. And so we do issue alerts for wind and waves when we have water. We don't actually put any alerts out for whether ice is safe or not, because it really it's impossible to tell.
And you mentioned just now when the ice is touching the shore. So there, I take it what you mean by that is there's times that the water might be open right next to the shore, but then a big chunk of ice a little bit further out?
Yeah, that ice, you know, we look at it from, if you look at it from a distance from the land, it kind of all looks like one nice little sheet. But when you get up close, you see that there can be fissures, there can be breakages, there could be parts where the ice rises up. That can be due in part to the wind, to wave action underneath the water. Remember that lake, even real close to the shoreline, is not going to be solid all the way down. There's still some liquid water down there. And so there can be still, you know, some action that helps to break it up from underneath.
We are speaking with Joe Moore, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Duluth and University of Minnesota Duluth, professor of earth and environmental sciences, John Swenson. So, John, Joe just mentioned that, you know, the water is under the ice. What is the water doing under the ice?
Another great question, Rob. Basically, if we think about Lake Superior in general moving, most of that movement is driven by the wind. So the wind blowing across the water surface applies a force to that surface and causes the lake to circulate. So the more ice we have on top of the lake, the more difficult it is for the wind to transfer its momentum to the water and move it. So it's not that the water beneath the ice is stagnant, but it moves less so than it does absent ice. Joe brought up a really good point about the role of wind here. And in my experience, you know, looking at ice formation and dissipation on the lake, it's so very intrinsically tied to the wind patterns. And I think that, to circle back to your opening statement about people who are ice fishing getting into trouble, a lot of that is tied to switches in wind direction and the resultant stresses that are applied to the ice and then cause that ice to move if it can, if there's room for it to move. And so there's this really interesting feedback between the atmosphere and the lake across this surface of this solid, semi-rigid surface of ice that really leads to some interesting behavior.
And part of that behavior was last week. What exactly happened? I alluded to it headed toward two harbors. I don't know how far it would actually get, but, you know, suddenly they found themselves on almost a vessel, right? You know, a moving ice floe.
Exactly. And Joe can correct me on this if I mess up the wind direction a little bit. But my guess would be that at a certain point in the day, the wind came out of the west, northwest, with enough speed to exert enough force on the ice that was in place to actually break it off, much like a geologic plate on the Earth's surface. And that that plate of ice then became a life raft of sorts and started moving generally in an easterly, northeasterly direction, and that was the problem.
Where did it finally end up, or did anybody pay attention to that after the anglers were rescued?
Yeah, John, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but this is Joe, and I think what probably happened is some of that ice ended up getting broken up to the point that it kind of got enveloped by the water and started mixing down. And ice is lighter than the density of the liquid water, so it does float, but it probably got broken up by the wave action. If you saw some videos of what it was like when that incident happened, you can see the waves are, it's a little choppy out there. Certainly not white caps like we see in the fall and the spring often, but that wave action probably helped to break up that ice and dissipate it. There was some additional ice that we did see form on satellite in the open waters, and we've since seen a lot of ice develop over the past couple of days. But it likely got absorbed by the lake. That helped to cool the lake, and then later, 12, 24 hours later, new ice formed on top as the wind kind of calmed down.
Mm-hmm. But how quickly can these changes happen? I say this knowing the answer is probably very quickly.
Yeah, like John said, it can change if the wind direction changes, or if the wind goes calm for a couple of hours in the middle of the night, and we have cool temperatures, clear skies, we can get really rapid ice formation. And we can track this on our satellite. We get 5-minute update images from one of our weather satellites, and we can actually track that ice moving. We could get a speed on it. That's how fast it can move, is that we could use our tracking tools to get a speed of how fast that ice can be, you know, moving from one side of the lake to another or developing or dissipating.
John, you captured some audio of the sound of the ice. Tell us what it sounds like and tell us what's happening when you do hear that sound.
Absolutely. And I think any of your listeners who's ever, gone out on the ice, either to fish or to just recreate in whatever form, has probably experienced these sounds, and they're haunting and they're very interesting. So basically, when you have newly formed ice, that's again using the plate tectonic metaphor, those plates of ice are interacting with one another, and they repeatedly they break. So basically, the equivalent of an earthquake, we have an ice quake, and the ice quake releases energy, and that energy propagates largely as sound. So you get this fascinating breaking sound, and I think the best analogy I could use is to go to Star Wars, and if we remember the lightsaber sound, the sound of the ice breaking, that signal propagating, sounds like a lightsaber being used like a sword. That's the sound that you will hear if you're close to the location of the ice breakage. If you're farther away, the sound changes a bit, and in the same sense that when an automobile passes and you hear the loud music being played inside the automobile and you really only hear the low-frequency bass tone, the same phenomenon happens with the sound in the ice, and that is the farther away you are from the breakage, you'll hear the lower-frequency component of it, and that will sound more like a whale song. If you've ever heard the recordings of, say, humpback whales in the ocean, kind of a low-frequency, haunting, crying sound. It's a beautiful sound.
Well, it's a beautiful sound unless you're on the ice. And if you look around and you don't see any humpback whales and there's not Obi-Wan Kenobi telling you to use the Force, you probably should get out of there. I know neither of you are necessarily ice rescuers, but if you do find yourself on the ice and suddenly it's doing something different than what you intended, what should you do? You know, what would you do?
I've actually fallen through the ice. I've fallen through the ice on Lake Superior twice in my younger years. I'd like to think I'm slightly smarter and wiser than that now. I'm not sure, but I think it largely depends on obviously the specifics of what's happening. If I were ice fishing and I stuck my head out of my tent and realized there was suddenly an open water, I would stay put and I would get on my cell phone and start making calls to get help. If I were walking on the ice and I were close to shore and I noticed that the ice seemed particularly thin and I thought it was starting to crack under my weight, I might actually lie down on the ice to distribute my weight across a greater area and reduce the stress that's causing the ice to break underneath me and try to slither my way off to a safer location. Those are my go-to emergency responses.
Joe, while John's doing that, what are you doing?
I'm probably not out on the ice if it's that thin.
Exactly.
I'd probably refer you to Minnesota or Wisconsin DNRs for tips for going on the ice. But, you know, as DNRs like to say, you know, no ice is completely safe. And so if you're going to spend any amount of time out there, it's good to review the tips that DNRs provide. Mainly if you're going out on the ice, you know, be prepared, have a plan. The best advice I would tell someone if you're going to go out in the lake and there's ice cover, definitely bring a friend, because if you fall or a friend falls, it's good to have someone that's available that can call for help quickly. Your cell phone might not work and you will not move as fast if you fall through ice. Things can happen really fast, really quickly. And so it's good to have another person that can call for help.
Right. My mother's favorite expression was, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. And John, your story of having fallen through twice, it seems to say you had quite a bit of experience. But my experience was at age 14 on Lake Michigan in Chicago, and it was so beautiful, and I thought this was so great. And then, whoosh, you know, I went right through. But luckily, there was an ice floe underneath the ice I was on.
So I
didn't get too wet. I was completely chagrined and learned my lesson very, very, very quickly. So,
yeah, I'll add to Joe's advice, which is excellent, sound advice. I'll make a plug for the Weather Service, and that is check the weather before you go out. And in particular, pay really close attention to the wind direction. And if we have winds that are out of the east, that's probably the safer conditions, because it's going to tend to, those wind stresses are going to tend to keep the ice pinned in to the western arm of the lake, to the nose of the wolf, if you will. If the winds are coming out of the west and they're strong, I would exercise really good judgment and caution and maybe stay off the ice that day.
In other words, that would be the express ice flow to Two Harbors, right?
That's right. That's the, yeah. That's the, yeah, exactly.
What, go ahead. Sorry.
I'll just throw a plug in, for the weather forecast from the National Weather Service. You can find that at weather.gov. Something people might not know is we do produce a pretty high resolution forecast. So you can get the hourly details. You can click on the map, and we produce it down to a kind of 1.5 by 1.5 mile grid. So if you click down by the lake, you're going to get a different forecast than downtown Superior, than the Duluth Airport. And so if you're looking on the website and you're going to think about going out on the lake somewhere, an inland lake or Lake Superior, just click on the map or enter the right zip code, and you can click around and get the precise forecast.
Right. And I will reiterate what John just said about the wind, and you said too, Joe, because it is kind of counterintuitive. I thought before you're schooling me here that the biggest issue was whatever was happening underneath the ice, but the wind is, of course, above the ice and seems to dictate a lot. What about smaller ponds and smaller lakes? I mean, we've got quite a few of them around here. Obviously, they're not the same as the big lake, but not forcing you to do anything here, Joe, but, you know, what size lake would be A-okay?
Yeah, when it comes to the inland, more inland lakes and what lakes are safe, finding the locals is the best thing. thing to do. Find the local bait shop, call them up, and ask for people going out on the lake, what's the thickness like? If you know any ice fishing businesses around, any bait shops, resorts, and that sort of thing, they're usually really in the know. And so even if you're just going to go out recreationally, those are a great resource for finding out if the ice is safe, or if maybe there's been a change in the weather recently and the ice is not safe. Those people can be, those local businesses and local resources can be a great resource.
So I shouldn't be misled by the size of the lake. There is no okay under this size or square acreage or mileage?
No, because the weather pattern can drive really quick changes. And so there may have been a lake that was safe and there were some really strong winds. And even if it's got some chunks of really thick ice out there, it might not be stable enough beyond walking on. It might be unsafe for vehicles or unsafe for snowmobiles and that sort of thing. So definitely checking out from any nearby local businesses that might know what conditions are like on the lake. That's a great resource just to double check, just to make sure that things are safer. Those inland lakes tend to produce a lot thicker ice than wherever we're going to see on Lake Superior, because they tend to not be exposed to as strong of winds and because they're so much shallower.
All right. John, any other final thoughts on it?
Yeah, I just add to all the great things that Joe said there. We haven't had much snow this winter, but one thing to bear in mind is that if we get a heavy snowfall that accumulates on ice, the insulative properties of that snow blanket can actually degrade the ice beneath it. And I speak from experience on this, thinking it's safe because there's, you know, it was safe before the snowfall, and all of a sudden you might find yourself getting kind of wet because the addition of the snow on top caused the underlying ice to basically melt. Typically, when you know, again speaking from experience, when you go through the ice under those scenarios, it tends to be a little more of a gradual falling into the lake, equally unpleasant but a little more gradual. So,
all right. Great. Well, we've been speaking with University of Minnesota Duluth Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences John Swenson and Joe Moore, Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service in Duluth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
I are sure you don't want to go ice fishing on Lake Superior this weekend, right?
No. Boy,
coming up, the regional news and review after this.
You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love. You never take advice. Someday you'll pay the price. I know. I've seen it before. It
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Robin.
And our own Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, Brooks, now that we know everything about ice on a big lake and the deep freeze has finally ended, was the deep freeze chased away perhaps by our hot housing market?
Oh, that'd be a good way to put it. It is just crazy out there. You know, in Duluth itself, there is just a month's supply of housing, which is to say that if all the houses kept selling at the current rate and no more were put up for sale, it would take just a month to completely run out of listings. This kind of competition and pressure is pushing people to the South Shore, actually. I talked to a realtor this week out there in the Bayfield area who said, you know, we're seeing a lot more folks who want to move up here to work from home. Typically, the area would see about 60% or so buyers looking for a vacation home or retirement property or a second home. And now that's kind of reversed, where about 60-70% of folks are moving out for full-time residence and are taking advantage of the area's increased fiber optic internet connections to work from home, to live in a place that they love, and work for a faraway company, as the pandemic has allowed and encouraged, in fact, many people to do. So it's a trend we're seeing in Minnesota and on the North Shore and increasingly now on the South Shore.
Well, if you want to go way up to the North Shore and check out the housing prices in Thunder Bay, you probably want to do that online, right? The Canadians aren't letting us over the border yet.
That's right, and they're actually restricting movement from Canadians into the U.S. and other countries even more. Last week, the Canadian government announced that folks who are entering Canada, those few who are allowed anyway, will now need to bring a negative COVID-19 test, and folks traveling in certain ways will need to quarantine in a hotel while they wait for results, and they'll need to provide another test following their quarantine. It's a crackdown meant to essentially discourage travel by Canadians to the U.S. and elsewhere, and the border remains closed to non-essential visitors to the country, with few exceptions for essential workers like truckers, nurses, doctors, and others who have family up there. But if you don't have family in Canada, you have a property maybe up by Thunder Bay, and you don't have an exemption, you still can't get there, and it looks like that's going to be the case for the foreseeable future.
Well, since you're stuck on this side of the border, you could give your attention to the Iron Range, where they're dealing with the 34-year-old murder case.
Right. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension announced last summer that they had cracked this cold case using DNA evidence and public genealogy databases, similar to the technique used to find and capture California's Golden State Killer several years ago. Michael Carbo Jr., 52-year-old of Chisholm, has been in jail since last summer, but his defense attorney is arguing that delays in the case, should cause some of this evidence to be thrown out. The public defender for Carbo argues that, we're not getting everything we should be getting from the DNA company that identified Carbo as a suspect in the first place, and they want to know all about the processes and procedures used to identify him so that they could potentially challenge the constitutionality of that evidence. Carbo remains in jail, charged with second-degree murder in the 1986 killing of Nancy Doherty. He's yet to make a plea in the case, and there's another hearing next week, so we may have another update next time we talk.
All right. Well, Danny, you've been telling us about battles on the Wisconsin side over the wolf hunt for the past few weeks. Have those now been settled?
No, not at all. But this week, the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board did unanimously approve a harvest quota of 200 wolves. That followed a judge's ruling last week that the state must hold a wolf hunt this month. And the decision comes even as the Department of Natural Resources is still appealing that ruling to put the judge's order on hold. If you remember, the Kansas-based group Hunter Nation filed a lawsuit against the DNR saying that, they should immediately resume the wolf hunt this winter after the Trump administration announced last fall that they would be delisting the animal from the endangered species list. That took effect in January, and since then it's been a real tumultuous back and forth over whether or not Wisconsin would have a wolf hunt. Right now, hunters can apply for a wolf tag. They can apply through Saturday, and a drawing of winners is set to be held on Monday. And then hunters can begin harvesting wolves as soon as they've purchased a license and gotten a tag. But that all depends on whether or not an appeals court ruling will come down. If it doesn't, they can move forward with the hunt and hunt during the last week of February. But there's still potential that an appeals court panel could rule in favor of the DNR and then put the hunt back on hold again.
Well, that sounds like any number of Wisconsin political issues. And an even larger bone of contention, I'm thinking, is the governor's budget. Or is the Republican legislature going to give him what he wants?
Highly doubtful, Robin. This week, Governor Tony Evers...
I'm trying to be an optimist here.
Well, we all want to be optimists. But, the truth is that there's a lot of opposition to Governor Evers' budget that he proposed this week. It's a $91 billion state budget. It's an ambitious plan that would boost spending by almost 10%. And that's raised the ire of Republicans because they say it spends too much. And it's full of policy proposals that Republicans are calling a liberal wish list. The two-year state budget that Evers proposed would raise taxes by about $1 billion. It includes a partial repeal of Act 10 collective bargaining law that limited collective bargaining for public employees. It would also seek to legalize recreational marijuana. Those are items that Republicans outright reject. Evers is also proposing to increase funding for public schools by $1.6 billion. That is the largest amount that a governor has proposed to increase funding for public schools in the last 15 years. It's bigger than his last budget and most certainly will be rejected by the Republican legislature as they scaled back that proposal to increase funding for schools significantly last year. And there are also a number of climate change proposals in the budget. There's a proposal to reauthorize the state's land purchase program, the stewardship program, for another 10 years. So there may be some opportunities for consensus on some energy items or on that land purchase program, but it looks like a lot of these things are going to be kind of just tossed by the wayside and that the Republicans would start over and write their own budget.
All right. Well, if I thought both the wolf hunt and the governor's budget were things that were easily settled, I will think again. We've been speaking with Danielle Kading, the Superior Base reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks so much, Robin.
And you can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/North Report. And be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter, because you really want to. Coming next week on Simply Superior, since the death of George Floyd and other tragedies dating back years, there have been numerous stories about the disproportionate use of force by police in encounters with African Americans and Native Americans. How do the Duluth and Superior Police Departments measure up? A Twin Ports data analysis group shares its findings. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with Why Not?, a song that should be a local standard. This cover by Veer Glider from the album Stripped and Acoustic Radio Songs. Stay safe, everyone.
You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love. You never take advice. Someday you'll pay the price, I know. I've seen it before, it happens all the time. You're closing the door, you leave the world behind. You're digging for gold, you're throwing away a fortune in feelings, but someday you'll pay. You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love.